Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our program for this Friday, the 11th of July. Very nice to have you with us. Hopefully you're all doing well. If you were in the path of the storms last night, I hope you did okay. I will say I was in my neck of the woods. I was driving through and I was like, oh, there are two very big trees in the middle of the road, or oh, that house used to have a roof, and it was pretty violent in some areas. So hopefully, everyone is safe and you're doing well, and we wish you the best in cleanup as we go through that. But also, just to realize the power of these summer storms as they come rolling through on a summer evening. With that, we wish you a very happy Friday morning and hope everybody has a beautiful day and a beautiful weekend. We welcome you. We'll talk about what's going on in the world, and we do so with just a terrific group of individuals. We also invite you to be a part of the program, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we would love to hear from you as always, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you, the Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Bo Breslin joins us. Good morning, Bo.
Oh, morning, Joe. I'm super excited to be here. I think, Joe, this is my 10th visit in the last couple of months to you, and I'm hoping that there's like a smoking jacket, like it's Saturday Night Live or something.
That's a great idea.
There isn't. we may be able to outfit you. I think we can get you a hoodie.
Okay, good. I'll take the hoodie. That's more my style anyway.
Get you a hoodie. But man, that's great. We so appreciate everyone. And I will tell you, we were out on the road this week. I was still in the group before we went on. We were out on the road this week. If those of you who were listening knew we were at Pittsfield, and for those of you that weren't listening, where the hell were you? that we went to Pittsfield, and we had a great broadcast, and so many people came up to us. And the thing that people keep saying is, oh, my God, I can't believe the just amazing people that you get on that panel. And I applaud all of you and to all of our panelists, and thank you very much for coming. And certainly the least that we can do is get you a $6 sweatshirt. Okay. We welcome Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Good morning, Malia.
Good morning. And I want to say it's been a little bit cooler this week. And so actually, I have my WAMC hoodie in my office at work. And when the air conditioning is a little bit too strong, I find myself wearing it regularly.
Yeah,
so thank you for that.
Very good. And Alan Chartok, our founder, always used to say when somebody was cold, he was, oh, we'll get them a shmata.
A shmata.
I love that word. So I always remember, that is sort of what's in my brain. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer of Times Union newspaper in the Greater Capital District, Jay Jochnowitz. Good morning. How are you?
I'm caffeine-free today.
Oh, ooh. By choice? Or yeah,
no, not really, no. I've got what they call a nuclear stress test.
Oh,
I've never had a stress test in my life. So as a journalist, it's like, I want a handicap. especially with the week I've had, as I told you before.
That was not a great week. You know, it's medical science is amazing to me. So I went into just a rather brief story.
This is what people do at our age. We talk about our medical fun.
and it allows me to tell a story that I think is somewhat amusing and yet also allows me to bitch about something. So I think that's good. But I had to get a sleep test. And I went into the Albany sleep lab in December. And to no fault of them, I'm not dissing them in any way. So they said, oh my God, we need to get you one. We need to get you one right away. How's August? True story. Okay. Okay. I now in December am free in August. So sign me up. So I go to see, and they're like, oh, we have an equipment, we have a bag, and we got to show you how to put the thing, and you got to put this on your chest, and then the stickies and all this other stuff. Okay. So I go to see my primary care doctor about 2 weeks ago, and she said, well, why haven't you had the sleep test? Because she had ordered it. And I said, well, I went in, and they said, how's August? And she goes, August? She said, I can have a sleep test delivered to you, like, in a day.
Wow.
And I said, okay. So, so 2 days ago, I get this thing in the mail, and Jay, it's the size of a Tic Tac. It's a little white orb that you put on your finger, and it has a little red light, very ET like.
Oh, wow.
You put an adhesive strip around it. You touch it against your cell phone, and then you sleep for 3 nights, and it records all your stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. So here I am.
And it stays on your finger the whole time?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it doesn't, it's not like it hurts or anything. It just, you know, does your thing. Now, I don't know what kind of information it gives. I have no idea. But I'm fascinated now to see where this goes from here.
Yeah.
But
that's cool.
Do I need the other one? I don't know. But it's fascinating. It certainly expedited things a little bit. So we'll see what happens. But I'm just saying a point of this story is that if I have been waiting for 7 months to get a Tic Tac, I would have been really mad.
There's some medical things that are appropriate that you can do at home, and others not. Like the VA earlier this year wanted me to do my own blood draw at home. They were going to mail me a device. And I said, no, no, no.
Wow.
No, I
will. Beyond your capability.
I would rather have a professional do this. And then they wanted me to show up in Miami, Florida at the VA clinic there for a blood draw.
Wow.
I said, no, I'm not going to, at my own expense, I'm not going to fly to Miami for a blood draw.
Because they can't do blood draws in Kingston?
I don't know what it was. I think it's this is like, I just want to say, like, this is what veterans deal with. That once you get through the bureaucracy to the care, the doctors are fabulous, but the bureaucracy just screws it up all over the place. I eventually, through a lot of back and forth, was able to get an appointment for a blood draw at the VA hospital right here in Albany, which was great. But it took me doing a lot of work to make that happen.
Well, it is. I'm glad you got it. Got it happening. I will say, and again, I we will talk about the items on today's list, I promise you. But my wife and I, and perhaps all of you have already engaged in this television program, but we are now completely involved in The Pitt, P-I-T-T, the Noah Wiley show on HBO Max.
Is that a medical drama?
It's a medical drama that takes place in so the device of the show is that it's 15 hours in a emergency room in Pittsburgh, and each episode is 1 hour of the shift. And it is stunning. And if you want to, and I think, and from what I hear and what I understand and what I've been reading, a fairly good representation of what a nursing room, an emergency room is like in a city hospital. And that's frightening. So,
the whole season is basically one person shift. It's like you get
you get to see all the doctors, and it's a teaching hospital, so they're teaching people, and you get your characters, and you get the people who are, it's crazy, but is it really, really good, and good stuff. We're kind of enmeshed in it now. It's a good show when you're like, do you want to go out to go see that show over at the Playhouse, or
stay in and watch The Pitt?
Stay in and watch 3 episodes of The Pitt. We'll do that. Good morning, everybody. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to it. I promise you, save your letters yelling at me for not getting to topics fast enough. I love you very much, but just give us a moment. Okay. So we go to, I know they're in here. We go to what's happening. Let's talk about FEMA. Let's talk about Texas. And let's talk about the deployment. Obviously, the story in Texas becomes more and more grim as time goes on, as the numbers start to rise. And the president is expected to be going to Texas. And now folks are starting to look at the rescue efforts that that took place. And certainly FEMA officials are saying that the search and rescue efforts in the Texas floods were slowed by budget rules. And these are budget rules imposed by Kristi Noem. So 2 days before the torrential rains turned the Guadalupe River into a raging flood, a veteran official with the Federal Emergency Management Agency told the Washington Post that one of the main concerns for this disaster season was the agency's ability to quickly deploy specialized search and rescue teams. The Trump administration's new rules mean disaster specialists can no longer make decisions on their own. The official then watched it happen in real time in Texas. Deployments of critical resources such as tactical and specialized search and rescue teams were delayed as a result of a budget restriction requiring Homeland Security Kristi Noem to approve every purchase, every contract, every grant over $100,000, according to dozens of current and former FEMA employees who spoke on the condition of anonymity, because they were not authorized to speak with the media. When rapidly responding to a billion-dollar disaster, that is basically everything, said one current official, meaning everything's going to be over $100,000. Other efforts by the administration to constrain spending have hampered FEMA's operations, officials said, which is likely to make it harder for the agency to be proactive during what is predicted to be a busy disaster season. Jay.
You know, it's been almost a trope for years for Donald Trump, and anytime there's a Democratic administration in Washington, the Republican Party, that FEMA can't do its job, that whoever, fill in the name of the president, doesn't know how to run FEMA. And now, you know, this is a test. And not doing so well. You know, I heard some early reports about this. There were also, you know, people were talking about the prediction problems of this storm. And I think the Washington Post or the New York Times did a story very early on that the way this storm kind of unfolded would have been very hard to predict. Originally, the forecast was, you know, nice. And then it was drizzle. And then it was going to rain. And then it was, oh, my God, get to the high ground. At 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, so that's been in my mind ever since I've been following this, because you don't want to do the cliche stuff of just, you know, let's blame whoever we want to blame, because that's what we want to do. We want to blame only the people we want to blame. We don't want to blame the people we don't. But in this case, it seems that the administration and, you know, so Trump is kind of distanced from this because it's Kristi Noem and Kristi Noem's doing her own thing. But, you know, this is a person who seems to be very scattered in her approach to the job. You know, she's out there, you know, modeling the latest, SWAT fashion at, you know, whatever event she, you know, she's showing up for. And she's now, I mean, if this story is, they didn't get into the details of how she is doing this, but is she sitting down with her phone or is she sitting down at a desk and actually looking at every piece of paper that says more than $100,000 on it and every contract? That's crazy. This is not how any executive. She was the governor of South Dakota. I can't imagine she did this as the governor of South Dakota.
The second word in that title is emergency.
Yeah.
And an emergency would tend to indicate that things need to move pretty fast to.
Ms. Noem needs to look at the contract
the
first.
Emergency.
Holy.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It is interesting. And also, you know, what exactly then? How much of what we're seeing is what we would refer to prior to this Trump administration a quote unquote normal FEMA response. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we're learning that as well. Bo Breslin.
Yeah. So, Joe, first of all, let me just say, let me just acknowledge what must be unimaginable pain for those folks who are going through it. I got a 26-year-old daughter. I can't imagine what it must be like for the parents of those Camp Mystic kids. That said, I'm going to be a little callous here, and talk about the politics of disaster relief, right? So let's think about it. You need, in order for FEMA to kick in, you need a presidential declaration. Both Democrats and Republicans are quick with that because there's benefit to being quick with declaration. But I did a quick and dirty survey. 85% of the FEMA was founded in 1979. Officially by the Carter administration, 85% of the declarations that FEMA has attended to have happened in red states, right? So it's mostly hurricanes. When it's blue states, it's typically wildfires in California or so on. 9/11 was one that FEMA obviously responded to. And so there is politics involved in FEMA. I will say, Trump is a master, Jay, this is what I think you're getting at. Trump is a master of shaping the narrative, right? So my daughter, my 26-year-old daughter's best friend works for FEMA out of New York. And she was deployed last year as a result of hurricanes. And she was met by folks in Georgia and Florida and so on with resistance. I heard the NPR story this morning that a lot of people in Texas are thrilled with FEMA at the moment. That's partly because Trump is a master of shaping the narrative. Mm-hmm. He comes out in the campaign and he says, we're going to either eliminate or reduce FEMA right out of Project 2025, right, which is all about giving states more power over FEMA. And then, if you're on the ground, any relief in an environment in which Trump has said we're going to reduce it, any relief that you get on the ground is seen as positive. So he actually did what is a strategically political move by saying we're going to make FEMA less important in as a federal resource, and then all of a sudden people are on the ground are delighted. When my daughter's best friend said FEMA under the Biden administration was a disaster. So his playbook is the Trump playbook of blaming and criticizing is part of the equation here. I'll say two more quick things. One is FEMA is representative of, in some ways, the way in which Democrats appear weak. So Trump comes in and the Republicans come in and they talk about fixing the problem. People are pleased in Texas about the way in which FEMA has responded. And Democrats with the sort of a liberal progressive agenda that Republicans describe as woke are seen as empathetic and weak, not strong. That's partly the Democrats have to figure out a response to that. And then the last thing I'll say is the article, Joe, there's a new article in The Washington Post that just came out in which we're not talking about abolishing FEMA anymore. We're talking about revamping it. This is a quote from that Washington Post article. Federal resources are intended to supplement state action, says the Trump administration. So it's about giving money back to the states. I'd love to have a conversation down the road about how all these institutions, from the Supreme Court to the president to Congress, are now trying to deflect things down to the state level and how that has real implications for protection of individual rights and so on.
You know, and also going into this red state, blue state divide as to who gets the upper hand, and we were seeing these reports of while the money and even with this delay, money being delivered to Texas much faster than to the people of California,
correct,
who are suffering from the fires that ravaged that state and the city of Los Angeles. Malia.
Yeah, as someone who used to work in federal government, I want to echo Jay's comments about this is not how you can run any kind of institution, especially one, as you said, Joe, that has the word emergency in the title of it. When I was in the Pentagon for my first couple years there, I worked in the Office of Homeland Defense Policy, which our job was to coordinate with FEMA to make sure that Department of Defense assets were organized in such a way that they could support FEMA-led efforts. So I'm intimately familiar with all the work that goes on behind the scenes, the immense amount of preparation that it takes for a disaster that you hope never happens, but when it does, you have to have done all that preparation work in advance. What Kristi Noem has done is so performative. This $100,000, it's so patently preposterous that would be the dollar level that she would randomly choose, because nothing's going to be below that. And it's also, it's infantilizing for all of her colleagues to assume like this entire institution, even if you think, okay, there's some bloat and waste, and maybe we can cut some positions from within FEMA, but still to concentrate all that decision making with her. What are these people down like within the rest of the structure doing? They're not allowed to have any thoughts of their own, and this is the way Trump wants a cabinet secretary to be spending her time, is which I assume she's not, actually, because I can't imagine that she is just tied to a desk and reviewing stacks and stacks and stacks of paperwork, looking at the details of every $100,000 plus expenditure. So it's preposterous.
But is that a power move on her part?
I think it's
it's a performative move. She likes it's something she can say, like, we're rooting out corruption, whether she is or not. She's actually causing more waste, fraud, and abuse by having this choke point with her. Is it a power move? It doesn't. I don't know what it gives her that she didn't already have, other than a lot more time in a chair reviewing paperwork.
Yeah, I mean, it's oversight, and you're going to always have the oversight.
Right.
I mean, all of us, I think, have worked at offices where they've said, you got $100, $150, and if you're getting it, and if you're going to get just the normal file cabinet, go order the file cabinet, give us a purchase order. If you're going to get the really good file cabinet, there's going to be a lot of money. We want to oversee that. Like, all that makes sense to me. But this is obviously much different, again, because of the emergency nature.
I think it's made for sound bites. Like, that's all it was made
for.
Yeah,
and I also think that I think Malia's right about the fact that the $100,000, which is a ridiculously low amount for FEMA or, quite frankly, for any federal agency, is a random number. And the principle or the strategy of we're going to root out all waste and fraud and have a number in the $100,000 range in order to do that. It's her way of sort of getting into the game, right? It's an Elon Musk moment where Elon Musk uses firing federal officials as his way to root out waste and fraud. Her thing is she's going to approve every $100,000. I just think it's part of this whole messaging and strategic approach to politics in the 21st century.
This is what I think is happening inside FEMA right now, because she is busy out modeling the latest in SWAT fashions, as you point out. She's not doing this. So instead, she has an aide. She is an aide who is doing this for her.
Yeah. Yes.
An aide that we don't know who that person is, who is making these recommendations. And that unknown person, who is probably pretty junior and some handpicked acolyte of hers, is making these recommendations to her and saying, this all looks good. Now you can sign off on it. And nobody understands from the outside, and I'm sure not in Congress, they're not paying attention. They have the oversight responsibility, but they don't know how this is happening. But I think that is the truth of the matter, that this aide, or maybe it's two or three of them, are that in secret making these decisions, and then she just signs off on it. And then the other thing that's happening is everyone below her office, many of whom are longstanding, nonpartisan federal employees, they're going to have to figure out some way around this, right? Because they can't do their jobs with this system in place. So there, I don't know what kind of scrambling they might be doing, but it encourages sort of like people to act outside the normal way of doing things, which is also not good for oversight and efficiency and all the things that we want out of our government agencies.
The reporting did say that they are doing some internal workarounds to deal with this. Right. They didn't quite. It was a little hard to understand exactly what the workarounds were, but it did refer to that. So you know, it's an agency that's gonna function in spite of her. But I also think. And I'll be real quick about this.
No, go ahead. No,
I want to hear you say. The reading the story, it was sometimes hard to separate. You know, whether they were talking about the federal government or the state government, because Texas's Department of Emergency, whatever their title is, has a big role here, and it sounds like they have some real problems with what they've done in terms of, you know, one of the things that was talked about. I wasn't sure if it was this story or another one that said that it was a different story we read that. That they had denied two or three requests for an alarm system for this very type of
the latest situation. This spring. Yeah. I mean, there have been calls for this type of system to be put in place for years. The latest call being just a few months ago, mm-hmm. Which is really interesting.
So that's probably going to be Trump's. They should have been raking the forest.
And, right. And Jay, your point is not insignificant because the struggles that Texas is having as a state on the ground are going to just be exacerbated in Louisiana and Arkansas and states that don't have the capacity. Mm-hmm. Texas has the capacity to be able to work the system better than the states around it. And so if you keep pushing the states, the responsibility down to the states, some are going to be able to do a relatively decent job, Texas and New York. Others, Arkansas and Kansas, not so much.
Yeah. Well, and to your point, and I'm just going to extrapolate just a little bit further, but especially when it comes to storms, Florida is obviously going to do better than Louisiana.
Right, correct.
And that is and that's problem obviously problematic. And just knowing what FEMA is and what it means now is a question mark. Right? Mm. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll take a break. We'll catch up with underwriting, and we'll be back to you right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We are talking about FEMA. We are talking about Texas. We are talking about some of the concerns that have taken place and delays getting Texas FEMA need and to address the problems that are on the ground and that horrific flooding that has taken so many lives with so many people still missing in that state. I want to go to the letters. I just have a quick question just for the group that I just, you know, I get like the smart aleck in me understands it, but the careful, thoughtful minded person in me doesn't understand it, which is why do you think like on all of these things that we talk about as far as cuts that are being made to the government, which obviously the Supreme Court had even more of a hand in this week, which we'll get to a little bit later. But why wouldn't you think, given the amount of situations, just common sense, that the situations that we have had that as we see these real emergencies upon us, whether it be in Texas or in California or in Florida or hurricanes and throughout the country, the way to counter this is by cutting funds to those agencies and not think that it's going to come back and bite you. And that's I just don't get that part of it, especially I would add, and this is where perhaps there is some commentary wrapped up in it as well, especially when it doesn't seem to have been done with any great thought. It was just numbers as opposed to, oh, well, this person does that and we should keep them, and this person does that and maybe we don't need that. That doesn't seem to be the case. They just went in and said, we got to get rid of 1,000 people. We're going to get rid of 1,000 people, and then they're done. And then something like this happens and you're like, oh, well, now what do we do?
I think it's part of a big overarching narrative, and it's one of those things that I actually think is one of those fair discussions to have in politics and governance and all that, as to what the role of the federal government is and how big you want your federal bureaucracy to be. If you want a federal bureaucracy that's deeply involved in something like emergency preparedness, emergency disasters, if you want a federal government that's deeply or moderately involved in education, you create an education department, you create a federal emergency management agency, you do these things. And then you can make an argument for that, because you could say, look, the federal government has resources that it can draw on, as we were talking about on the break, defense resources, for example, that you can draw on that the states just don't have access to. Or you have another theory of it, that the states need this, but they can't print money. That's the one thing they can't do. So why don't we give them the money to run their schools? Why don't we give them the money to run their emergency management operations? Why don't we give them the money to do their highways even? Mm-hmm. And on and on and on and on. So it's a fair discussion to have, but I think the operative point here, first of all, I think it's wrong. I think the federal government does have better resources for an emergency like this and greater resources that states shouldn't just be keeping on hand, although they may have to as climate change gets worse. But it's the idea how thoughtfully this was done. And I don't think it was done thoughtfully. I think it was done conceptually. And we're still in the conceptual phase. And in an effort not to be callous, but I think this is these are the consequences.
Yeah, so
of the callousness.
I mean, I think that's right, Jay. And I'll Joe, I think it's the exact right question that you're asking. And I'll approach it two ways. One as a political cynic, and then secondly as a political scientist. As a political cynic, he who controls the narrative.
See, I can only do half of that.
Yes.
I can only take care of that. Which, by the way, more fun. Just to be the cynic. But go ahead.
It is more enjoyable to talk.
Yeah, but use
cynically,
your degree. Right? You go ahead.
So, as a political cynic, he who controls the narrative controls politics, right? So it may be, Jay, that you're right. It may be based in the principle that, you know, Republican Party is all about lesser government and so on. But really, it's the Trump administration's ability to, and I sound like a broken record, to successfully control the narrative. That's why you have the people like Pete Hegseth and Christine Noem. They look good in front of the TV. They talk well in front of the TV. The Trump administration, Joe, this is the cynical part of me. The Trump administration is not thinking five steps down the road like previous presidents have thought, both on the right and the left. They're thinking one step down the road, and one step down the road is about controlling social media, controlling television, controlling the news and so on. And so he who controls the story controls the outcome. That's why local folks are saying FEMA's great under the Trump administration and less so. The political scientist in me says something a little bit different, which is the Trump administration is trying to play to a traditional Republican base. And Jay, this is where I think you're absolutely right. The traditional Republican base says we have to reduce the imprint or the footprint of the national government, and as a result, states will take up the responsibility. Now, I think as a good democratic liberal, I think that has tragic consequences over the long term. That said, in my lifetime, Reagan, the Bushes, up to Trump. All Republicans have tried to give power back to the states in a way that's sort of a traditional conservative mentality. And I think Trump is having more success because he's also controlling the narrative.
I think the fact that we live in a complex world makes it easier for the Trump administration to put out the narrative that they want. In situations like this, it's really hard to draw a direct cause and effect line because there's so many different factors coming in. So they can come in with their own explanation. And if they're confident about it, a lot of people in the world are convinced by confidence, right? So and this is another reason why I think the Trump administration is anti-education. So that people don't develop or don't have the information to understand for themselves, how did this situation come about? So the counter narratives aren't being developed by the people who are affected. You know, they're busy trying to react to this terrible thing that just happened to them. They don't have the wherewithal or maybe the understanding of like deciding why did this happen to me or how was the government to blame. And I think that's part of why we have less civil society talking, you know, sharing counter narratives than we've had before.
You know, there's the famous Mark Twain quote that actually was my quote in my yearbook, which is all you need in life for success is ignorance and confidence, and then success is sure.
So was that your personal quote, or did somebody put that on your?
No. I was a Twain fan. But so you've got the confidence, and you could argue you have the ignorance, but we're not seeing the success in this point, which is interesting. And I guess it depends on
Who you're talking to.
That's right. It depends on how you grade that success. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of letters. give you an idea of what kind of kid I was in high school. So we go to a couple of letters. Here's my favorite. This is from Jan. I was going to read this last, but it's my favorite, so I'm going to read it first. I have a question. Is Christy Noem using an auto pen? I'm just asking.
Ooh,
it's like that's a good
touche.
Good line from Jan. Like that one. Tim writes, if Christy is out of the office, then nothing gets approved. Delay, delay, delay. That's the Republican way to not have to pay, said Tim in the best Dr. Seuss way possible. Suzanne says, I have heard that both the Biden and Obama administrations had provided funds for flood warning systems in Kerr County as part of infrastructure initiatives that were either turned down or reallocated to the sheriff's office. While I am sure the internet wouldn't lie to me, does anyone know if there is any truth to this? Because letting your children drown to own the libs is monstrous. I do not know about the Biden and administration, Obama and administration parts. The stories that I have read, and panelists, I throw this out to you if you know anything different. The stories that I have read that this was a state issue, mm-hmm. and that this was both a county and state issue as to the needs of setting up this emergency system of which they felt those funds could be allocated better elsewhere.
That was my understanding of
Me
it too.
Yes,
and that's what I was saying. This isn't all about FEMA. It's also about the state of Texas, and they're going to have to answer for that in Texas to some probably very angry, grieving people, and just people who didn't lose anyone but lost possessions and property and so forth in the course of this, and they're going to find out that it was less than $1 million for this system, I think, was the number. It's crazy. A state the size of Texas, not spending something that could save people's lives. Three times.
A listener, Jay, writes, could someone explain to me how it's legal to slow relief funds to certain states and not to others? As well as how it's legal to have concessions from one state like Alaska to not get hit with cuts while every other state is allowed?
I mean, I think legal is a dangerous term there. How it's moral? Sure. I can't explain how it's, you know, fair, just, moral. Politics and the law oftentimes don't mix, so whether it's legal or not, I'm not sure, but it's certainly immoral.
Yeah, legality is
tricky.
Given the Supreme Court, I mean, if it all comes down to whether the executive is doing anything illegal, I think the conclusion from the Supreme Court is no, nothing the executive does nowadays is illegal in the sense of prosecutable. So you might be able to file a civil case about it, take them to court and argue about this, I guess. But I think the crass politics is something that I don't think the law can ever really fix. Well, they could. There is it's corrupt in that sense. Denying people what they're entitled to.
Joe, at the risk of missing my cue, can I respond to a little bit to the previous letter that, and say something about the fact that, you know, again, I'm putting on my political science hat. Politics these days is, you know, we know it's all about the blame game and so on, but it's all about hindsight is 2020, especially in this particular arena. And I wonder to what extent Hurricane Katrina, where there was this incredible outpouring of, you should have done this, Louisiana, you should have done this, Washington, D.C., and tragic loss of life. 1,800 people lost their lives in Hurricane Katrina. But I wonder to what extent that moment in American history changed the debate about emergency response. And maybe, Malia, you have a better sense of that. But that strikes me as kind of the threshold for us to now look back. There's no there's plenty of reason. I shouldn't be hyperbolic. But I'm not surprised that there was talk about a warning system and it was ignored at the state and local level in Texas, right? That sort of happens all the time and it's just happened to be that this particular river has a catastrophic 100-year-old, genuinely 100-year-old, because we throw out 100-year-old storms all the time. This is a genuinely 100-year-old storm. And all of a sudden, somehow there's others to blame because there wasn't a warning system. Well, there are lots of places around the country where they haven't put in warning systems that have not experienced this, and we don't pay any attention to that. So my point is, the blame game in politics is a winning strategy in the 21st century, and it's just a little unsettling.
Well, I think Trump has found a way around that. All I have to do is write checks. Everyone else is to blame for what they do with the money. I mean, and that, you know, is essentially that's the cynical side of that whole long argument I gave about the philosophical idea of downsizing the federal government. If you just hand money out, then you're not to blame.
I just wish. And I know, you know, I know this is silly, but no, I don't think it's silly. I think it's very important, but I do think it's naive. But, you know, until bodies are found and the situation has improved and services have taken place and some calm has been restored, there is plenty of time for blame.
Yeah.
There's plenty of time for finger pointing. There's plenty of time. But my God, we still have people in trees, for God's sakes. Let's work on that instead of this. And I know the media is partially responsible for that in some regard. However, I just wish that were more the focus sometimes than who is to blame. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have other items to discuss, and we will do just that. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel and our roundtable panel segment. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Just a couple of letters. We've been talking about FEMA, and I wanted to get to a few of the letters that we had to be a bit more complete. Bill said someone called Trump a master of framing the narrative. Not so fast. It's conservative media, Fox and Newsmax, OAN and X and Truth Social, etc., that's framing the narrative. And there's no effective counterbalance to that thumb on the scale. Why is Fox the highest rated news channel? Then we go to this letter from Warren, who says, one of the aspects of the administration's downsizing of federal workforce is the silence surrounding the fact that the administration is backfilling many jobs with MAGA supportive workers who are occupying roles that are not political appointments and who will be under the radar screen when a different administration comes to power and needs to have non-MAGA aligned federal employees who will carry out the political agenda of that new party. And that is from Warren. Then we go to Naomi, who says, whether emergencies have been politicized by climate deniers, whether any emergency is due to climate change or not, there is an effort to dismiss disasters as pure paranoia.
You know, just to go back one letter, there's always been a churn in any government. When a new administration comes in, it's usually those, you know, I watch it at the state level. It's usually, you know, the limited number of discretionary at-will jobs that exist and commissioner-level jobs and assistant commissioners and stuff like that. But you have, you know, what Trump and his MAGA call the deep state is the thing that, you know, has long kept government running, the professional class of civil service. And it's troubling that the Supreme Court has basically given a green light to this particular firing, but what's going to be, as this letter writer points out, probably or suggests, is just a constant turnover of a huge part of the federal workforce, because you're going to have all these competent or incompetent loyalists in government, and a new administration is going to come in and say, you know what, I'm going to bring back everyone that the last guy fired because they were good workers, and then and all those people may come back, they may not, they may say, hey, you know, I'm not going to come back to a workplace where I could be fired at every 4 years. So, I think Trump, Project 2025, and the Supreme Court have together created a real mess here.
So let's talk about loyalists. You brought it up. Let's talk about it. Typically, the FBI has turned a polygraph test to sniff out employees who might have betrayed their country or shown they cannot be trusted with secrets. Since Kash Patel took office as the director of the FBI, the Bureau has significantly stepped up the use of the lie detector test, at times subjecting personnel to a question as specific as whether they have cast aspersions on Mr. Patel himself. In interviews and polygraph tests, the FBI has asked senior employees whether they have said anything negative about Mr. Patel. According to two people with knowledge of the questions and others familiar with similar accounts, in one instance, officials were forced to take a polygraph as the agency sought to determine who disclosed to the news media that Mr. Patel had demanded a service weapon, an unusual request given that he's not an agent. The number of officials asked to take a polygraph test is in the dozens. Several people familiar with the matter said, though it is unclear how many have specifically been asked about Mr. Patel himself. The use of the polygraph and the nature of the questioning as part of the FBI broader crackdown on news leaks, reflecting to a degree Mr. Patel's acute awareness of how he is publicly portrayed. Wow.
Yeah.
Oof. Creating a police state does not start with creating. I mean, it does start with fear in the populace, but it starts with obedience. This is going to be my 1984 rant for the day.
You go for
George,
it, Jay.
George Orwell.
But at a time when we're seeing, a massive expansion of Homeland Security into the biggest force, you know, a armed force in the United States, and bigger, I believe, than all but four of the world's militaries. And we're seeing these kind of Handmaid's Tale sort of, you know, dressed up guys in ski caps and guns in the streets, grabbing people and throwing them in unmarked cars. If we are not on the cusp of a police state, or if we are not potentially on the cusp of a police state, I think we've got our heads in the sand. And don't ask me how I go about the rest of my day when I have thoughts like that and think, oh, I'll just have a normal day. But I do think that the possibility is there, and it's terrifying. But it doesn't start really with the population. It starts with absolute loyalty and fear in the bureaucracy itself. If you remember, the proles in 1984 were free to do whatever they wanted. Basically, they could gamble, they could sing, they had their lives, and the government did. They didn't have to worry about it. And if they got out of hand, then they disappeared. But it was the people in the government that had to not only be obedient, but in the extreme world that George Orwell pointed, they couldn't even think something wrong. And to the idea that people are being hooked up to a lie detector now to figure out what they think and what mm-hmm. they say mm-hmm. and what they feel is a terrifying thought, that this is what the government's becoming. This is how you get a deep state, not a deep state. This is how you get a state, so, in the worst sense of the word.
Agreed. Joe, we'll call this section of your show, Where is George Shultz When You Need Him? Because George Shultz was the one, Reagan used polygraphs to try to weed out leakers, and George Shultz threatened to quit. And so Reagan backed down on that. We need a George Shultz at the moment to do this. Now, polygraphs for FBI agents, subpoenas for doctors. That was another story, treating trans kids, firings at the DOJ, firings at the Department of State. I could go on. Tariffs, bullying universities, threatening law firms, replacing boards like the Kennedy Center, reducing funding at NPR, PBS, closing USAID, Abrego Garcia. These are all part of the politics of intimidation. And the politics of intimidation is working at the moment. You have things like Christopher Wray, right? Remember Christopher Wray stepping down because he didn't feel like dealing with the incredible pressure that's put on from the Trump administration. So I think it's the politics of intimidation is part of the equation, as we all know. Fealty to leadership, loyalty to leadership is part of the equation. The question is, where do we go from here? There is no George Shultz there that's telling Kash Patel, you know, I'm going to quit. So the question is, how do Democrats respond? What's the next step for opposition? Where do we go from here? And I think that's an open question.
So many of these FBI agents who are getting this kind of polygraph have probably been polygraphed before. It's a normal part of being in an agency where you require you have to have some kind of security clearance. So I got polygraphed several times in the past, and the test. It's not conclusive, right? This is not a science that is absolutely precise, and it measures your reactions to things, and then the human interpreter of that draws conclusions from the way you react to the question. And so I can imagine, you know, someone being asked a question like that, you know, wondering, you know, even if they hadn't publicly cast aspersions about Kash Patel, thinking like, oh my gosh, did I at some point like write in an email something that could be, you know, it just, if your mind is racing about something like that, like thinking, could someone interpret something I did as negative? That's going to show up on the polygraph, and that will perhaps be interpreted by someone to indicate that you're saying yes, that you did, even if you didn't. So that is, that's, it just shows why this is it's more of a fear-mongering device and policy than actually ferreting out anyone who is doing something that the administration thinks is wrong, which, by the way, is their right as an American citizen to express their opinion.
And can I, Joe, leap forward to another story we might talk about, and that's Fed Chair Powell for a second?
Yes.
Because Fed Chair Powell, it's interesting. Powell is facing the level of political intimidation, and he holds his ground, right, for good reason. He, you know, his job is not in jeopardy, at least until May, right? But he holds his ground. And what was interesting, and riffing off of what you said, Jay, Kudlow said just the other day that the Fed has to be cleansed because it's part of the deep state, right? So we need to get Powell out of there because he himself is part of the deep state. Right. The use of deep state as a boogeyman is also part of the new politics as we see it. And so, again, my question to the entire listening audience is, what's the next step? How do you respond to the use of deep state as a boogeyman, especially when it so plays with 51% of Americans?
I think you just, if in personal conversations, just say, to what deep state? What are you talking? Yeah. What specifically are you talking about? You know, and they'll say, well, you don't. Go do your research, you know. You know, and then you have that back and forth, and it's useless. I don't know.
So, color me naive, but have you ever said anything negative about Cash Patel? Yes.
Sure.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Like what?
Okay. Well, if the story, last line of the story was, as one FBI agent put it, who hasn't complained about their boss?
Right. Well, that's right. I mean, that's what I was getting to. Like, right. what, you know, who hasn't at some point? You get frustrated. You do, you know, your eyes roll and you're in a bureaucracy and okay.
Okay, but Superficial Bo says Cash has got thin skin. I'm sure it's not quite that, right? I think it's just part of a network of action on the part of the Trump administration in order to make sure people recognize that we're 1984, we're looking over your shoulder.
Yeah.
It's just another tool that they're using.
All they have to do is a few people.
And what's interesting, in preparation for today, I looked back at the Republican Party platform. Number 9 on the Republican Party platform, and there are probably 20 or so principles. Number 9 principle of the GOP party platform is end the weaponization of government against the American people. I see that the Republicans have stepped up the weaponization of government, as in all the list I've given you, tariffs and bullying and threatening law firms and universities and so on.
Let the record show. Bo prepares.
He sure does.
As
do you all, of course.
As a student of China, I just want to share that. So, of course, you can't, if you're a Chinese citizen living in China, openly criticize the great leader, Xi Jinping. So they develop all kinds of ways to get around that and coming up with clever ways to allude to him. That are well understood, and that's why you find things like suddenly, you know, Winnie the Pooh is no longer somehow somebody equated him, and so you're not allowed to talk about Winnie the Pooh anymore. But that's what we'll start seeing in this country as well, or inside the FBI. They're not going to stop complaining about the boss or anywhere else. They'll find some other way to refer to him,
unless they get that terrified.
Unless they get that terrified,
that terrified that they curl up in a corner outside the view of the telescreen and write in their diary, mm-hmm. you know. I don't know. You as you pointed out, this is not uncommon to use lie detector.
But I have polygraphs. To say, even someone. So I've taken one several times, just as a normal part of getting a security clearance, and I know I haven't done anything wrong. I have nothing to fear. But it is nonetheless nerve-wracking to go through this experience, even if you know that you're going to come out fine the other end.
I mean, I had a family member that went through one, and it was for a top job, and for working with both the state and would have consequences for both the state and federal levels. And the again, you walk in there and you know that you haven't done anything wrong. And yet this person came out just sobbing because the person who was giving the test would wince sometimes when an answer was given or would say, oh. And the just those sort of manipulative things that were done. And then 2 weeks later, you learn that you passed with flying colors, you got the job, and everything is fine. But, I mean, that's part of the process, too, right?
Well, somebody in the story – I'm sorry.
Well, I don't recall – I've never had someone do those exact things to me. But the way it's said, it's supposed to be an intimidating experience.
Right.
You know, you're by yourself, except for this person, who in my case was behind me. So I felt like, you know, like his eyes drilling into the back of my head the whole time. You're hooked up to all these different sensors that are, and you're not allowed to move. And it's like over an hour, you are sitting in this chair in a windowless room. With the padded windowless room, looking in a corner, you know, answering yes or no to all these questions, and thinking, if somehow this doesn't show up the right way, because I'm feeling nervous about this whole experience, then this could impact the entirety of my career, even though I know I've done something, done nothing wrong.
I know. This family member, I felt like, okay, I'm young. I'm female and I'm alone with an old guy in a room with a machine.
I've had that experience
up.
Too, yes.
Yeah, and it's a bit disarming.
Do we have a second?
Yes.
Okay. I'm always struck by you know all of these tools and tactics of what I'm calling the politics of intimidation, but it's about fear. Like Jay, you said, it's about fear. It's about getting people in line. It's important to remember that a central core principle of Project 2025 was to eliminate up to 50,000 high-level federal government employees and get the right people in, right? And so what better way to do it if you can't actually fire someone than to intimidate that person out of a gig or out of a job and so on? So I actually think, you know, this is going to be a super unpopular thing to say on the at the moment, and I'm squeamish to say it, Joe, but has a president had more success in fulfilling his agenda in the last 25 years or 30 years than Trump has? I disagree with everything he's done. I think it's shameful. It's a lack of dignity. Rights are being violated and so on. But he is having success in his particular agenda, Project 2025 agenda, and I'm not sure it can be matched by any other president. Part of it is this intimidation factor.
It's working for him.
It's working for him.
All right. Just a few more moments, and we will go to a break and talk more about other stories making news. I do, when we come back, obviously, we'll talk more about the, because Beau brought it up, about the Fed Reserve Chair Jerome Powell resisting President Donald Trump's calls for lower interest rates, and basically doing what many people do not have the luxury of doing is ignoring him. And that shows the power of that position, because you can, and oh, by the way, he was named by Trump, but you can ignore him. And most people don't have that.
And the court the high court has been very. I don't think they've offered as much clarity as they really need to offer on these independent positions. You know, within the Trump circle, at least, I think to maybe intimidate Powell. You know, there's still this suggestion, or at least from Trump himself, that you know he could fire Powell if he really wanted to. This has been a problem with the Kennedy Center, with all these other entities that have been created by Congress. But unfortunately, we have a situation where Congress isn't really putting up a fight over that issue. And it ought to be a really big issue, the idea of independent inspectors general. the idea of independent agencies. You know, I get, you know, kind of the philosophical disagreement here, but if Congress says we're creating this so it is independent of the political pressure from the executive branch, then that should be respected by the law, and the courts just have not really offered absolute clarity on it. So for Powell to be doing this, I think he's just confident that, you know, this is a fight he would win, and he probably doesn't have to take it out of his own pocket. It's probably the Fed that's going to pay for it.
Yeah, and you're right about the courts. You know, the Supreme Court has been reluctant to get involved in separation of powers issues at that level, and so
which is, you know, really it's what they should be. I mean,
it's easy when you have the discretionary jurisprudence. When you can only take 60 cases out of the roughly 10,000, you can decide where you want to dance.
Given the importance of that issue,
yeah,
they shouldn't be able to dodge it.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we welcome you. We'll finish up our time together and have a couple of stories to discuss. We always welcome your letters. Panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And when we're in our final moments, keep them as short and to the point as possible, and we can get to as many as we can. We will return after these messages and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 34 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Friday, the 11th of July. Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said yesterday that the state of our democracy keeps her up at night, echoing a theme that has animated some of her recent public appearances and fiery dissents from recent decisions. Quote, I'm really very interested to get people to focus and to invest and to pay attention to what is happening in our country and in our government, Jackson said. The nation's first black female justice and the most junior member of the court did not elaborate on the point, which came during a wide-ranging live stream discussion with U.S. District Judge Jane Magnus Stinson at an event sponsored by the Indianapolis Bar Association in Indiana. Over the past two terms, the High Court's conservative supermajority has dramatically expanded the power of the presidency, giving Donald Trump and other presidents broad immunity from official acts taken in office, scaling back the ability of lower courts to block policies through nationwide injunctions and greenlighting many of Trump's precedent-shattering executive orders for now, even as lawsuits over their legality make their way through the court system. Jackson has emerged as one of the court's sharpest critics, issuing more dissents than any other justice during the term that ended last month and strongly denouncing aspects of several rulings for the Trump administration. How important, and I guess the other question I have is, how unusual is it, Bo, to have a justice speak out in such a way?
It's very unusual in a couple of ways, Joe. And I think this is fascinating because, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the Supreme Court is that it's the only real remaining sort of behind the curtain mysterious institution in American national politics. And so we don't actually know what's going on. Maybe we read, you know, Bob Woodward's The Brethren or so on, but the mystery surrounding the court is interesting. So when you have a battle, a verbal battle between Justice Jackson and Justice Amy Coney Barrett in this last one, it's saying something. So here's my theory, and I got to tell a quick story. Antonin Scalia, Nino Scalia, changed fundamentally the nature of the whole Supreme Court process. Why? Because he realized when he gets on the court in the mid-80s, he realizes that his power is limited in an environment that's based on hierarchy and based on seniority. So the way it works is that, when the justices go into conference, to talk about an individual case, the chief justice talks about the case first, and it goes down the table in order of seniority until the most junior justice talks last about the individual case. And then they take a preliminary vote, and it works its way up the table from the most junior justice all the way to the chief justice, who has the final vote. Scalia recognized that didn't work for him because he wanted to influence his fellow justices. So what did he do? He decides that he's going to use oral argument as a vehicle to talk to his fellow justices about his position, thereby getting out in front of conference that would happen later on in the week. So he starts yapping away. I think Justice Jackson's doing the same thing with her. She wrote 27 opinions this year alone, second only to Clarence Thomas, who usually writes a paragraph or so on, but 27 opinions, the most dissents. I think she's telling fellow justices what her position is, not only on the individual case, but her larger political agenda or larger political principles for future use, because she doesn't have a lot of influence when it comes to conference, especially because she's a junior justice. So I see her taking a page out of Scalia's book, and her fight with Amy Coney Barrett represents Amy Coney Barrett being kind of frustrated and finally saying to her, you need to relax a little bit. You're not following the Constitution. You're doing political stuff. But I think it's her way of influencing the court through the written word, just as Scalia did through the oral arguments.
Malia?
Thank you. I learned something from that. I didn't realize that that's how it worked. I just think of this in the context of the public view of judges and how we see those positions becoming sort of uncommonly public. Like, people know the names of judges now, and judges are receiving all kinds of threats and have to hire bodyguards. I just hope that Justice Ketanji Jackson has a really excellent security team, and more power to her as she shares her opinions.
Jay.
I my sense of her is that she's a person who also, beyond all the power dynamics on the court and all the frustrations that individual, especially junior justices, may have, I get the sense that she's a person who really thinks her being on the court is not a moment to waste. Kind of thing, that that there is a power to being a Supreme Court justice. Everyone is going to read that dissent, and if there's an alarm to be sounded, she's not going to be calm about it. It's not going to be measured words. It's not going to be just to go back to our Kash Patel thing. This isn't a control question. You know, the idea that somebody suggested in the piece, that the idea, have you been disloyal, is just a control question, just to get a baseline on your reaction to a stress question. She sees a real problem here, and she perceives it, and she's talking about it, and I happen to agree with her wholeheartedly on her concerns. This is not a normal moment, and I think Coney Barrett, as much as I like some of the things she's done in terms of not always agreeing with her colleagues, and looking like sort of she's maybe she's a little more not quite middle of the road, but somewhere in those lanes. I think she was just trying to bring her up short.
Yeah. So
and say, this isn't how we do it, dear.
And I think you're right. You're absolutely right. And I too am a huge Justice Jackson fan. So I think she's on the money. I'm a big Sotomayor fan. Here's the interesting thing, right? Any appeals court, usually three, but at the Supreme Court it's nine. Any appeals court is a consensus building institution. In order to be successful, you need to get four other people to agree with you. So from a political perspective, I'm not dismissing or even marginalizing what Justice Jackson is doing in writing all of these dissents. But she has the luxury of writing dissents because she doesn't have to build consensus at the moment, because she knows she's not going to be able to build consensus. There's going to come a time when, you know, Thomas is gone, or being the most senior justice on the court, or Roberts steps down or something like that, when it's a little bit more balanced ideologically and Justice Jackson is going to have to build consensus. The question is, will some of this stuff, she's very, very critical of the majority, and in a sort of a undiplomatic, according to the conservatives, way, has she shot herself in the foot by having these very pointed critical dissents against people like Barrett when she's going to eventually have to build those consensus? That's what's interesting to me.
Well, you know, Scalia, to talk about another person who was abrasive, to say the least. I mean, he and Bader Ginsburg got along famously in their private lives, but he was abrasive too. Would we be having this conversation? Would America be having this conversation if Ketanji Brown was a white man?
Yeah, you know, totally legitimate question and totally fair. I think the answer is no. It would be a different conversation. So, Jay, you're absolutely right. But what I will say is, and I'm not a big fan of Scalia. Scalia was ruthless with, you know, with black men and others who had done various things, especially around the. He all but called out Sandra Day O'Connor on one of the Casey abortion case. So Scalia was ruthless, and, you know, he maybe got a pass for that sort of thing. But he was in the exact same position, at least in most cases, as Justice Jackson is now, because he and Thomas were so far on the right that they were often in dissent and they were often on the margins, and they didn't have to build consensus until later on. I think Ketanji Brown Jackson is doing that same sort of thing at a time, and Sotomayor does too. Elena Kagan is a little bit more diplomatic. And so the question is, you know, maybe Elena Kagan is the one who will sort of lead the liberals moving forward. I just think it's fascinating as the court develops over time.
You know, when people read something or say something or watch something and then they go, well, there's a half hour I'll never get back in my life. Here's the time I want back. After the election, and everyone started to talk about the court and how Justice Roberts was going to take a hard look at the court because they realized that they were giving power now to a president who was returning, and how they were going to very, very carefully and deliberately look at this to make sure that these 6-3 decisions were not a regular thing and were something that was thought out much more thoughtfully and perhaps even courageously. I want that time back.
Yeah, we're not getting that.
Okay,
we're not
but getting that. You know, and I always get in trouble with my folks because I have gone down fighting in trying to defend Roberts, who I disagree with ideologically and I disagree with in terms of constitutional interpretation. Some of his stuff is absolutely absurd. His Harvard affirmative action case decision was just irrational, if you read it. That said, if there is one given, Joe, in politics, it's I'm convinced that Roberts has tried his best to keep the court institutionally minded. I actually think over the last, say, 3 months, he's sort of given up on that. And he realizes he's outmanned. I think early on, leading up to the Trump 2.0, and in the first month or two of the Trump 2.0, you see this in the Brego Garcia case where he's like, you need to facilitate the return. I think he was trying desperately to hold on to a court as an institutional-minded institution. And over the last month, he's sort of said, "I'm out. I'm losing no matter what," and he's given up.
It's hard not to draw some kind of parallel between the court and the country as a whole when you mentioned the inability to have some kind of consensus, and this person who feels marginalized then becomes more vocal about her point of view in ways that we haven't seen a lot in the past. And I just see that happening sort of on the national level, that you have a lot more people more polarized, as we've talked about many, many times, and the polls are more vocal about their opinions.
We are out of time. I want to thank our terrific group for being with us this morning and for providing us with so much thoughtful insight into these issues, and for being so great. Bo Breslin, Malia DeMond, and Jay Jochnowitz, thank you so much. You all are wonderful. Have a beautiful weekend.
You too.
Thanks
for being
Joe.
With us.
You too,
Jeff. We will continue with the roundtable and go to our Congressional Corner segment right after this.